Hi, and welcome to the CMO Alliance podcast, where we break away from the usual marketing chatter and deep dive into the most vital topics within the marketing sphere. I'm Michal, your host and your guide to candid conversation with industry's top leaders. Each episode will uncover actionable strategies, real-world case studies, and the personal stories behind their success. So whether you're navigating a tight budget, managing cross-functional teams, or scaling growth in a competitive landscape, you've come to the right place. Today, we're joined with Steve Kaiser, CMO at Ordway, who's led marketing and product management teams at five different SaaS and tech companies. Steve has driven high-growth ventures, including billion-dollar valuation and market leadership position in Gartner, Magic, Coordinates, and Forrester's Wave. Steve, thank you very much for joining today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm surprisingly in a good mood to talk about a topic that I think most of us try to avoid whenever possible, which is budgeting.
So. Yeah, I think that nowadays, even more than ever, it's extremely crucial to talk about it, to get, you know, like best practices and different point of views, and especially that we're kind of like rushing toward Q4. So a lot of budget discussions probably already has initiated, and yeah, it will kind of like unfold for different marketeers. Steve, would you mind telling me a bit about your background before we kind of like deep dive into the topic of budgeting?
Yeah, so I've had a fairly diverse background. I've been in the software and technology space my whole career, but I've done a bit of work in, I actually started off as a developer writing code for software and moved into product management. I spent about 20 years in marketing, but I've done a few short tours of duty in the sales organization. Mm-hmm. Along the way as well. So I've had a good tour, if you will, of all the different go-to-market functions and have been at a variety of different size companies, most of them small or mid-size, but I've been at early stage startups that were less than $1 million in revenue, and I've been at publicly traded companies that were over $2 billion in revenue.
Wow.
So that's really the lens that I can offer on the budgeting process in marketing in general.
Yeah, so that's also a lot of like diverse experience, right? So I think that also it's really important, you know, for us marketeers to understand how different functions not only operate, but how it really feels. So the fact for me that you've kind of like, you know how to write code, you also have been involved in sales, actually it's a great benefit for you as a CMO.
Yeah, exactly. It makes me a better partner, I found, to the head of sales or the chief revenue officer, because I've, as we say in the US, I've walked a mile in their shoes.
Yeah.
I know how hard that job is. I don't want that job, but I have an appreciation for the culture and the pressure that's on sales. And the same thing on the product side, that's an incredibly challenging job as well. And so to the extent that marketing can offload or make the product leaders and product organization's job easier, that's good as well. So
100% agree. I'm going to start kind of like with the first question that we have in line before we deep dive into the whole budgeting. But maybe for the starters, how do we ensure that marketing metrics and performance are clearly communicated to different stakeholders within the organization? So like the CEO, CFO, and even the board sometimes need some kind of clarification around what kind of marketing vision and strategies are you going to lead. So how do you ensure these communications with them?
Yeah, well, these days we're so metrics obsessed, particularly in the software industry, that it's almost impossible to avoid that. But I would encourage you to actually take the time to build a strategy around the metrics and the data storytelling that you plan to do within the business. And the storytelling can be a little bit different within the marketing team and versus talking to the overall go-to-market organization or at the executive meetings or at the board meetings. There's a different level of detail that's required at each of those. And a different level of simplification that's required. But get ahead of the metrics. Don't let the finance or the operations team define the metrics for you. They're often going to do crude things, you know, and just take line items off the income statement or, you know, push a button in the CRM system to come up with things. One of the things that I've had some success with is actually defining your own metrics. Which the investors that are on your board will particularly appreciate, because there's a little bit of a a competitive rivalry that exists, I found, between all the VC and the PE firms and trying to figure out what the best metrics to track are to predict go-to-market performance and overall performance in the business. So if you can come in with a unique point of view of, I look at it this way and this is the way that I calculate it, they may or may not necessarily agree with that, but they'll certainly have a respect and you'll catch their attention for doing it. So, you know, one good example is that every company I've been at, I've always measured not only just the raw lead count and opportunities moving through the pipeline, but also the number of leads that have BANT. So they have budget authority, need, and timing. And that's interesting because the conversion rates through the funnel ought to be a lot higher for leads that we've confirmed have BANT than ones that don't, mm-hmm. right? If they're not, that's an obvious red flag. But you can also sort of narrow down where you might have a problem if you're missing your targets by looking at something like that. So if 60%, 50% of the leads that you're bringing in do have BANT, you're getting the right kinds of opportunities. You don't really have a demand gen problem, I would argue. Now, if those BANTed leads you're not winning them, it's not so much a demand gen problem. You might have a product feature functionality problem. You mm-hmm. might have a sales execution problem. You might have a reputation or brand problem in the market. You might have a pricing or commercial terms problem. But it's not that you're not getting well-qualified leads for Myers that are in the market. And we all know some percentage of those BANTed leads always end up in no decision. There's not much we can do about that. But that's one example. And then, you know, don't be afraid to adjust the standard metrics as well. Like, customer acquisition cost is a big one in the software industry. True. And if you let the finance team define that, they're just going to go to the income statement and take last quarter sales and marketing expense and, you know, or divide it by the number of customers and come up with this raw number. But we all know, particularly in bigger marketing organizations, there's a lot of things that we're doing that don't have anything to do with new customer acquisition. We might be supporting, you know, we might have an internal agency that's creating training videos or slides for executives or hosting internal meetings, things that have nothing to do with customer acquisition. Mm-hmm. So you want to take those expenses out, things like CAC if you can. And if you get out in front of that and you start defining the things yourselves and reporting on them yourself, then you start to own that metric versus waiting for someone else to define it for you. And then you're mm-hmm. on the defensive end. So
I think that one thing that is really interesting is how do you choose what metrics do you want kind of like to communicate, right? Because there are so many different metrics that for us marketeers tells a lot. I don't know, for example, website sessions or, you know, like website site duration, et cetera, page views. But of course, CEOs, usually they don't care about it. So do you have any kind of like frame of work or kind of like best practices for marketeers who are just like starting through building their reporting for CEOs or for different stakeholders in within their organizations?
Yeah, that's an excellent question because a lot of those metrics, we have a lot of vanity metrics in marketing and we True. Don't intend them to be vanity metrics, but they tell a good story at an individual campaign level or an individual channel level that's really not reflective of overall things. So I try to avoid those. I mean, like, for example, email open or click rate on newsletters that we're sending
redundant,
out, right?
It's
very easy to increase that, right? Yeah. If I'll just send it to people that are highly engaged that tend to open and click on the emails and all of a sudden the percentage goes up dramatically and you look like a hero, but you really haven't done anything. So, I try to measure the ones and report on the ones that are most closely tied to the overall business performance. So, mm-hmm. you know, I do report on leads and pipeline coverage, but marketing source bookings, whether that's expressed in revenue or the total contract value, the number of marketing influenced bookings and wins, you know, pipeline coverage, overall pipeline. And then, I don't think it makes sense to be having a conversation at the executive level about every single campaign that you're running, because I think you're starting getting to the weeds, although there's sometimes an appetite to do that, I find. I tend to look at the top five or 10 budget line item expenses. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're spending $10 million a year on search ads on Google, then I need to be able to show the return on advertising spend mm-hmm. there, right? If we're spending a lot of money on an outside SEO agency, I need to be able to clearly quantify what those things are. So I tend to start at the top of where the biggest line items are from a vendor expense standpoint and be able to justify those and have a narrative around those and try to avoid this conversation that we often get into about, well, there's 20 different trade shows we sponsored and why are we doing these four? You know, that's just stuff at the executive level I don't think is a good use of time. Like, mm-hmm. I tend to think about the marketing investment almost like you would have a stock portfolio. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm going to invest in 20 stocks and hopefully 15 of them are going to grow in value over the next couple of years. There's going to be a couple that for reasons I can't foresee are going to go down in value. But if the majority go up overall, we've, you know, had a very nice capital gain on our investment, but trying to pick just individual winners and losers and second guessing, you know, why you might've picked the stocks that didn't go up. It really just isn't a good constructive use of time. You learn from it. Definitely review it, but obsessing over it, I don't think is the best use of time. So, sorry, long answer.
So let's move forward for the, you know, to unfold the whole topic of budgeting. So what will be your approach to balancing long-term brand building initiative with short-term demand generation, especially with the CFO or board may prioritize immediate ROI? You know, so we all know that usually, and especially in startups, marketing could be a bit more tactical and less strategic, right? Because they want to see ROI, they want to see new leads, they want to see, you know, like new closing deals. So how do you kind of like create this nice balance between your vision as a marketeer and your strategic approach into these more tactical approaches?
Another good question. From my perspective, this is arguably the number one challenge that I think we face as CMOs right now. Mm-hmm. This balance between performance marketing and brand marketing, or if you want to call it demand generation, as we often do in the B2B space. Because there's definitely a strong preference from CEOs, CFOs, investors to focus on the performance marketing because you can more easily quantify the ROI. Mm-hmm. But as we all know in marketers, that's kind of a short-sighted strategy. You're almost forcing marketing to think like the sales team does, where we're just thinking about the next 30 or 90 days and not thinking long term. And it ends up being a lot more expensive and putting more risk into your plan by focusing on that. Because if you're an established market, so one where you're not introducing a new category, it's a product that's been around for a while, 10, 15, maybe at best 20% of your potential buyers are going to buy in any given year, and the rest aren't. But they probably will buy in the next 3 or 5 years when they switch jobs or when they switch roles within the company or something happens that there's a compelling event that they need to make a change in the products that they have. And so I think it's a huge mistake to be ignoring that 80, 90% of the market that isn't in an active buying cycle right now and just focusing on the demand gen stuff that's going to go into the funnel. Because we've all seen those studies that have been around for 10 or 15 years now that when you ask buyers how they do research and how they inform themselves about purchases, most of them will say, I've done 60, 70, 80% of the research that I need to make a purchasing decision before I'm even willing to talk to a sales rep from a vendor.
True.
And so you want to influence that their thinking before they're going to engage. Of course, we'd like to get to them before they do that 60, 70, 80% of the research, but in a lot of times we're not going to be able to. And increasingly, you know, although we have all this technology and we get all this data, we are completely blind to a lot of those early stages in the buying cycle. A lot of the influencing decisions are being made on Slack channels, like the CMO network, CMO Alliance,
True.
Slack channel. So a lot of the conversations are happening on things like the CMO Alliance Slack channel, right? They're having on private Zoom conversations like we're having right now. They're happening at roundtables where people are getting together in person and it's an invitation-only thing for C-level executives. And you can't get any visibility to those sorts of things. Maybe you get some intent data, but it's very generic. So you need to be out there constantly trying to influence people, even that are not in the market. And that's really where the brand marketing stuff comes in. But I think I found, at least in the software industry, that the word brand has a very negative connotation. It's almost as if brand...
But it's like, yeah. And I don't know why is that. Maybe because it's less measurable.
Exactly. It's less measurable. And I think there's just a general trust issue that exists between the CEO, the CFO, and the marketing organization. Like there's a historical perception that there's probably some validity to that, that marketing spends a lot of money on things that there really isn't any quantifiable return on investment for, and that part of marketing is just what we might call a slush fund of, you know, people sending people to events and traveling and printing things and making things that don't really have an impact. And we ought to be more focused on things that, that we know work. But it's almost as if branding needs a rebranding. So I've been trying to use different words instead of using brand, which I immediately can see the facial reaction of the person I'm talking to is okay, whatever, that's arts and crafts, you know, marketing that, that I don't care about. Using words like recognition. So what's our name recognition? How many of our potential buyers have heard of our company? And then the second R is reputation. What, and if they have heard of us, what do they think about us? What's our company reputation? And there's very little argument I found when you use words like reputation, every CEO cares about that because you can immediately explain, well, what do you mean by reputation?
That's a great tip. You know, I even learned something new now because usually I call it positioning. What's the company positioning?
Yeah, which is an accurate term. But again, it's one of those terms that's been around for a while that I think when people hear it, they go, oh, here we go again. The marketing people are using their terminology.
Yeah.
But when you talk to a CEO or an investor about the company's reputation, are we the employer of choice? Are we attracting top talent? Are we that company that everybody wants to go work for? Are we the one that everyone thinks is growing fast, that investors are proactively calling because they want to put money in even when you're not out fundraising? You know, are we the one that's got the buzz in the marketplace? I've yet to meet an executive or investor that doesn't want to have the leading reputation. And that's really what a lot of the marketing brand investments are doing is, you know, particularly when you're trying to be out influencing the influencers or doing thought leadership with the media or speaking at conferences, you're trying to position yourself, as you said, and build that reputation. It doesn't necessarily mean that that discussion about the budget for those things isn't still there, but it at least gets more nodding of the heads and acknowledgement.
Yeah.
But I think, as you know, to circle back on the original question, I think these things like public relations, you know, out of home advertising, the general advertising that's not top, you know, bottom of funnel, that's not leading to immediate conversions into leads, events. Those are the three areas that there's just continues to be a lot of friction, a lot of tension, a lot of discussion about, you know, why are we spending so much on Facebook ads? Why are we spending so much on LinkedIn ads? And as marketers, it's just obvious to us, right? Like if I know LinkedIn's going to guarantee me they're going to surface ads in people's feeds that are the right buyer at the right kind of company, and we know that for certain, why would that not be something we want to spend money on? If there's an event where there's 1,000 of our target customers at and our prospects are there, our competitors are there, why would we not want to have an exhibit and a presence there? Now, I think it's fair to have a healthy debate about should we be the platinum sponsor that is paying $1 million for, you know, Taylor Swift to sing at the after party, or should we be the one with the 3-meter by 3-meter or 10-foot by 10-foot stand, you know, that's at the bottom of the exhibitor tier? I think that's a good debate. But why we're there, to me, really shouldn't be a question, but it still often is, right?
This leads me to my next question, which is usually CMOs are working very closely with CEOs, and there's a lot of discussions around the budget allocation, which we've kind of like started to scratch the surface on. How do you kind of like advocate for the resources and for your team while you need to balance, you know, between potential financial constraints or any kind of like friction points between you or maybe other stakeholders in within the C-suite? So do you have any how-tos, best practices that you can share with us?
It's another big area of challenge. I give you two ways to think about it. One is offense and defense, to use a sports analogy. So let's start with the defense. One thing that I've underestimated and not done a good enough job of at the different companies I've been at is really just taking the time when you start a new role to really understand the CEO and the CFO's perspective on marketing, how they think about things. And they'll tell you honestly how they think about it. And if you're smart, you're actually asking the interview so you can see whether there's alignment before you decide to take a role. But often, you know, one mistake that I made a lot is the CEO will ask probing questions. What's this person doing, or why are we doing this campaign, or what's this expense that I saw, you know, for X amount? And I find myself, I'm often in such a rush to answer the question that I just forget about it as soon as the meeting's over. But anything that they ask about more than once, there's a reason why they're asking, and it's going to come back to bite you, particularly when there's a need to reduce budget or make hard decisions about things. So take note of those and really think through either better ways to explain them or maybe ways to cut back on those things if they're not getting the results that you think. So that's sort of the part of the defensive play. The other thing I would encourage you to do is when you get into these budget discussions, particularly for any resources or agencies or campaigns that you feel that there's a concern about, have two or three data points that you know off the top of your head that you can say, you know, what is this person doing? Well, they're doing X and Y. And the more that you can tie that back to one of the important corporate initiatives, either one of the CEO's pet projects or something that's in the OKRs or something the board asked to, that just immediately resolves the concern. Oh, that person's working on the sales kickoff. And if they're not here, we're not going to be able to do that event the way that we want to in February. Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Move on to the next one, right? You want those really kind of quick, concise answers. If it takes you 5 minutes to explain what the person's doing, that's going to be a contentious discussion. And the same thing with the agencies and the campaigns. Why do we need an SEO agency? It's hard for us because we're immersed in it. But you've got to be able to have that quick answer. If we don't have that, we won't be able to do X, Y, and Z. And here's 1, 2, 3 things they've done in the past 6 months. Mm-hmm. Now, on the offensive side, I would come in with a well thought out plan. As the marketing leader, we should have a perspective on what the total addressable market is and what percentage of that we can service, how fast the market's growing. You know, if the market's growing that we're in 35% a year, should we be growing at 35% a year? Or maybe we should be growing at 70% or 50%, you know. What share of the market do we have? If we're going after global 2000 companies and we've got 500 of them, mm-hmm. is that the right number? Is it realistic to try to get that number up to 600 or 700, or should we try to do the land and expand strategy where we are just trying to sell more into that base of accounts? So have a viewpoint on those things and tie all those things back to what you're trying to do mm-hmm. with the budget. So, because often you don't know the total company number when you start these kinds of discussions, but you appear to be a lot more strategic mm-hmm. when you come in with that view.
So if I need to recap, the first thing first is participating, like active listening. So really listen yes. to the voices of the CEO, CFO, boards, etc. The second thing is kind of like know how to communicate very clearly the value of the different marketing activities so that you will have an answer, you know, if you know, the circumstances kind of like require that. And then the third, how would you kind of like frame that? So the last one, maybe more around be prepared or know your strategic vision. And again, know how to communicate it in a very clear way, right? So kind of like three top.
Yeah, tie the marketing budget to the long-term exactly. company plan, yeah. right? Where are we trying to be in 5 years if we're thinking about an exit? Where are we trying to be in terms of market leadership mm-hmm. or market mm-hmm. share? And try to tie the budget back to those more types of strategic things. Because like I was saying, often when you start the budget negotiation process, the new business or the total revenue plan for the year isn't quite finalized. And so you don't know exactly what that target is.
Yeah.
But if you put things in that longer term context, it usually.
Good. Thank you very much for that. What advice would you give to other CMOs when it comes to negotiation and collaborating with various stakeholders? So how would you kind of like approach a budget discussion? You know, so we're now rushing toward Q4, a lot of budget discussion probably already started and they're going to unfold in 2025. Any kind of like best practice for someone who's doing it maybe for the first time?
Yeah, so we've touched on some of them, but I'll add a few more. Data, of course, always bring data when you can because that helps. There's a lot of things that we don't have data for. There is a lot more data out there than you realize as well. You know, one of the things that I always encourage people to do is be able to explain how your competitors are spending on marketing budget.
Oh, that's a valid point.
There's a lot of data out there that you can collect that I think a lot of marketing leaders don't necessarily think about. Like you can go to their LinkedIn profile and it will show you on the insights tab for the company how many employees they have in marketing. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, on average, you know, a marketing FTE that's in a Western country is 75,000 per year. So I'm going to take their total headcount, multiply by that, and I've got an estimate of the headcount budget. We can go into tools like SEMrush or Moz or Ahrefs, and you can see an estimate of what your competitors are spending on search ads per month, right? Mm-hmm. So they're spending $100,000 on this keyword and $200,000. So you can quickly arrive at what some of their digital campaign budget is. Mm-hmm. If you look through their social feed on LinkedIn or X, you'll see all the events that they sponsored. And you can go look, oh, well, they were the platinum sponsor here. They were the gold sponsor here. They were the diamond sponsor here. And your events team should have the cost for all those things. So you can come in and say, look, you're complaining about events. You know, we have our top three competitors spent X million dollars. And here's how I know that. Here, this is backed in data. There's no way around disputing that kind of stuff. Now you have to be careful with the delivery of this. Because if you're sort of under attack or being criticized for why you're spending on something, you don't want to come in and try to one up your boss or the other leaders and show them, well, you're actually completely wrong. Here's the data. You have to be very gently sort of insert this stuff into the conversation and make it a little bit more casual. Mm-hmm. Otherwise you risk just, putting that person even more on the defensive. So that's one strategy. And then some of the other things that I talked about, you know, just be prepared to defend any major program and then every headcount, you know, with those quick kind of action points. It's a big challenge. You know, the active listening, as you said, helps as well. You can somewhat predict if you do a good job of listening, you can predict what they're going to ask you about.
Yeah, I would say it's a lot also of like relationships. So really getting to know what ticks the person. And then it's also help you to know the right angles, what this person like or sometimes even hate, and then it's easier to navigate these really hot topics. Good.
Yeah, and one thing I don't do a good job of that I should, but I know is a best practice, is just don't think about the budget conversation as just happening once a year.
It's a constant discussion, I would say. It's a constant discussion, especially in this dynamic market.
Exactly. And you know, proactively, whether you're doing QBRs or just regular meetings, you know, show the metrics, show where the spend is, get feedback at least once a quarter, because you'll learn through that. And they're not necessarily, you know, if there's concerns about the performance of the ROI of something in March or in April, it's much better to know it then than waiting till November and December and finding out, because then you can't do much about it. Mm-hmm. You know, the program might just get cut before you even have time to do additional research and come back with more data.
Yeah.
But we often try to avoid, whenever possible, talking about the budget, right? Because it's an uncomfortable conversation.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're proactively doing it, it.
I think that you're touching a very interesting, you know, like point, which is getting comfortable with topics that are uncomfortable, especially for marketeers and especially in today's market. So thank you very much also for bringing that into our discussion. Two last questions from my side, which are a bit more on the fun end of the interview. So what is your proudest moment in life, if you don't mind sharing with us?
Well, that's a tough one, right? I have three kids and I can't pick one of them in terms of
maybe being a dad, just in general.
Yes, being a dad for sure on the personal side. You know, on the professional side, I had an opportunity actually to write a book about e-commerce, which was something I never thought
that's
I was going to get done.
Just yeah.
It's quite a bit of time and energy that you have to put into that on top of your normal day job. So that's one thing I'm particularly proud of. So
great. And what excites you most, especially now that we're coming to the end of 2024? Any something that you really want to achieve, you know, in 2024 or planning for 2025?
I think, I don't know if excite is the right word, but I'm still very passionate that marketing is both a left brain and a right brain function. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a desire to just focus on the left brain stuff, and generative AI is here and it's going to do everything for us. And all we need to do as marketers is sit back and train the models and look at the metrics. But I still think we're a long way before the AI can eclipse the creativity of humans. So I'm continuing to be excited about human intelligence, which we need both artificial intelligence and human intelligence, and continuing to motivate people to come up with creative things. Mm-hmm. AI only can create things that already exist, right? Humans have an infinite capacity to come up with new content, new ideas, new positioning, new marketing strategies that don't exist. And I think in this AI-centric world, that's how the only way you're going to be able to stay ahead of the competition is by constantly innovating and coming up with those new things. So that's something that I'm constantly kind of pushing my team, you know, don't just become solely dependent on the technology, and that isn't your one and only job. We hired you because you have the ability to apply human intelligence as well. So
I 100% agree with you. And, you know, like now, you know, when you answer this question, I thought to myself, a lot of marketeers now, you know, they have like in their title in LinkedIn, like it used to be data-driven marketeer. Now it's like AI-driven marketeer, AI content yes. architect marketeer, et cetera, et cetera. How about human intelligence-driven marketeer? How about, you know, like we focus on you know, like kind of like playing to our strengths. What are our strengths? Being human, having, you know, like, as you said, these infinite ideas or brainstorming or, yeah, human-to-human interaction, I would say. I think that that's kind of like something that people will really appreciate in the future, especially post-corona, AI, so human-to-human interaction. Yes. I think that that will kind of like probably become trendy in the future, which is interesting, but let's see.
Yeah, and I think you make a good point about the profiles, right? I mean, AI to me is almost unnecessary at this point to even mention it, because every company says they're an AI company. Every yeah. company is a co-pilot. Everyone's changed their title to say AI. It's like cloud was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's become almost a meaningless term that is just ubiquitous. Yeah. So, but yeah, you're right. Like, it's still humans that are buying the majority of the products that we're selling at the end of the day.
And also we're writing to humans. Like, we need to remember that, you know, people can detect ChatGPT for miles. So
yeah, we are obsessed with beating the algorithms, right? And even before ChatGPT came along,
SEO.
There's so much SEO written content that is just utter nonsense, but for some reason ranks at the top of the search engines. Yeah. But that's just making all of our lives more difficult, right? Because you've got to wade through that to actually find what you're looking for. It's almost polluting the internet in a way.
Yeah,
I don't think it's going away. I think it's going to be more pervasive. But,
yeah.
But like you said, yeah, it's humans that are reading it. So
yeah. And now even, you know, you have like SEO for AI and, I don't know, AI-driven SEO techniques, more interesting things to come. That's for sure. Great. Then Steve.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I would say thank you very much for joining us today. And thank you for this lovely and super interesting interview. And thank you for the audience for tuning in for this episode of CMO Convo. We really hope you found today's conversation insightful and with actionable takeaways, which I'm sure you have. If you enjoyed the episode, be sure to subscribe to our channel so that you don't miss out on any future discussion with top CMOs and marketing leaders. We've got plenty more disruptive ideas and inspiring stories coming your way, so stay tuned. See you next time. Bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of CMO Convo. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a rating and review on your preferred platform. Don't forget to tune in next week for another insightful conversation with a leading CMO.